Today we're going to start on baptism, and I'm willing for this to go. It's definitely going to take 2 weeks. It could go as long as three. Up front, I'll just tell you now, this week is going to be mostly me talking at you. So think of this as a lawyer's opening argument, where I'm making a presentation. You're going to have questions, and I'm going to get to it at some point in the presentation. And if not, we're going to have two more weeks for you to ask me lots of questions and say, wow, Ben, you're wrong about all that. We'll have time for all of that, but if you'll let me get through as much of the early material as quickly as possible, you can kind of get my point of view up front. More than any other class we've had so far, this will be Ben's point of view, in the sense that when it comes, we have zero information in the Bible about kids and baptism. There is nothing to work with. Okay. So all I can give you are principles, some proverbial guidance, and my personal experience. And that's what we're going to work with. You don't even have to agree with me. Okay. More still, when you disagree with me, I will support you in that. Okay. I have baptized people I thought weren't a great idea for that person to be baptized because the parents said, we're convinced and this is what we're going to do. And I said, I support you in that. Okay. So I have some moral responsibility in it, but you're the parent. Okay. So you understand there's some give and take there. So I'm going to give you my guidance, but then at some point, somebody makes a decision. And that's not always me. So all I'm doing here is giving you my point of view, and I'm openly admitting it's biased based on my experience. As a preacher, I get to see some of the worst case scenarios involving baptism, and that makes me sometimes gun shy with kids in baptism. And so I err in one direction. Parents tend to err in the other direction. And guess what? I'm a parent, so now Lucas is coming to that age, so now I've got to figure out, okay, great, I'm not just his preacher, I'm his dad, and what does that look like? And so it's a different thing. You know the rules. Last week we talked about the gospel and defined the word gospel as basically this story. For I deliver to you as of first importance that I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 4, Paul says, the way we reenact that is through baptism. It is the reenacting of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ.
But Isaiah looked forward to a day when a new king from the line of David would come and deal with evil, but in a surprising way. The king would become a servant, and not just serve, but also suffer and die for the evil committed by his own people. And his life would be offered as a sacrifice.
This was the promise Jesus believed he was fulfilling. He's the king of Israel, suffering and dying on the cross.
In fact, Jesus himself used Isaiah's words when he said that he came to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And that word ransom refers to a sacrifice of atonement. And so all over the New Testament, we hear about how Jesus' death was an atoning sacrifice for us. It covered the debt that humans owe God for contributing to all of the evil and death in his world. But the New Testament authors also talk about Jesus' death as providing purification. And so we hear about Jesus' blood as a symbol of his life, having this ability to wash away the vandalism that evil has caused in us and around us, so we can now live at peace with God.
So that's the meaning behind Jesus'
death. And that's where we left off last
week. But there's more to the story.
Yeah, the New Testament makes this powerful claim that Jesus' death was not final. He rose from the dead. And so he's the sacrifice who broke the power of death and evil, which means that he lives on to offer his life to anyone who will accept it. He is the perfect sacrifice to which all the previous sacrifices were pointing all along.
So because of Jesus, the early Christians stopped participating in the ritual animal sacrifice.
But they were given new rituals. There are two that Jesus taught his followers to perform. The first is called baptism. Just as Jesus died, so going into the water becomes this personal connection you now have to his death. And in coming out of the water, you, so to speak, come back to life with Jesus. So baptism is this sacred ritual that joins your story to Jesus' death and his resurrection. The second ritual is called the Lord's Supper, which is a reenactment of Jesus' last meal with his disciples, and he used bread and wine to portray his coming death as a sacrifice. And so now, followers of Jesus, they take the bread and the cup regularly to remember and to participate in the power of Jesus' death and in his life.
So these rituals, they remind us of God's love and encourage us to live a life of love and grace.
But they do more than that. They connect us to a new life source. The very power that brought Jesus back from the dead is the same power that can deal with the evil in our own lives and transform us into people who lead lives of love and peace.
Okay, so that's the rest of that video I showed last week, is that the gospel story just flows into the discussion of baptism and also communion, which we're not talking about at this exact moment, but that'll be afterwards. If we ever get through baptism, we'll get to communion. And they are responses to and reenactments of the story of the gospel, that basic story. In terms of terminology, what kind of terms are we trying to convey? Baptism, in some sense, is symbolic, meaning you're literally doing something that represents something else. Okay, so we're going to say that as a symbol, baptism tells the story of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. It is a, for your benefit, it's a tool of proclamation. It says, this is the story, and I'm acting it out. But again, for children, it's telling the story. Okay, with baptism, the church has historically always associated with confession, that is the appropriate time to make the confession of your faith in Christ Jesus, okay? And that's the historical principle throughout all of church history. In all of its strange and various forms, baptism and confession have always been associated. In the early years, it was more of a question, do you believe that? And then sometimes you'll see where it's the person, you know, supplies the confession. I believe that, but in any event, you can see both examples. It's not a problem. I typically ask it as a question because people are nervous in front of people and I don't want them to say, blah, blah, Satan. You know, I want them to get it right. So I say, do you believe that? And then they say yes. And I take that as sufficient. For kids, the confession, the only distinction here I would make is that this sense of confession is not like confession of sin, which is itself a biblical notion. This is a profession. It is a confession of faith in Christ. It is the confession of a sin of the culture, in the sense that you're saying, I believe something that other people would find very strange. You see, it's a confession in that sense. The Romans will look at you and say, you believe what? I confess. I believe Jesus is the Christ. But it's a positive statement. The mode of baptism in Scripture, it is a covering. It's the meaning of the word baptizo. There is essentially no debate among scholarship that that's the meaning of the biblical text. Now, historically, there have been other modes that have been offered, sprinkling, pouring, and things like that. But in terms of the biblical text, there's no one of any serious academic standing who's saying that there's any example of anything in the Bible other than a full immersion. And so in Churches of Christ, we take that as the principle, and we follow that mode. Purpose, next slide, I'll get to that in a second. The result will be something like what was said in that video, beginning of a new life, and participation as a member of the church, that you're beginning a life to do something. It's not just you've moved from one category to the other, but now you're beginning your life as this. I'm starting out to do this. It's a moment of initiation. Okay. Purpose, let me zoom in on that just a little bit. The Bible presents a variety of reasons for being baptized. None of them are, it's not like you pick one, it's they're all true. So I'm not looking for a magic incantation that your child needs to say the following words or else you don't get it, right? Sometimes in Churches of Christ we emphasize Acts 2:38 for the remission of sins as if that were the only verse in the Bible about baptism. And it turns out it's a verse in the Bible about baptism. There are others. And all of those reasons are good. If somebody says, I want to be baptized to obey God because he said to do it, that's a good reason for me. I want to belong to a church family. And that's something that happens in baptism. I say, that's a perfectly good reason. To be forgiven or / remission of sins would be the reason given in Acts 2:38. To begin a new life would be the Romans 6:4 reason. Okay. So all of those, whichever is given to me, I don't say, you got to say the magic words, right? As if there's a litmus test. If you give me a biblical reason, I'm going to say, yeah, we'll baptize you. In principle, all of those are happening. But I don't expect kids to, again, recite to me a list of things. The more of them they understand, the better. but keep that in mind. Age threshold guidelines. And that's the question we all want to fight about, okay? Mm-hmm. There is no clear age threshold for baptism in Scripture. It simply doesn't exist. In Christian history, there have been two major schools of thought. And I'll start by picking one, because we fall into one. Churches of Christ and many others, we're not the only ones by any stretch, practice what's called credo baptism. You may have never heard that term, but it's what we practice. Credo is Latin for I believe. So this is believer's baptism, okay? Meaning that baptism is based on present faith and confession. We baptize people who presently are capable of having faith and expressing that faith in a confession. Who would not be able to have faith and express that faith in a confession?
Infants.
Yeah, babies can't do that. And so the alternative kind of baptism that some other churches practice is what's called pedo baptism, which is just the word for infant or child, which is based on future faith. So they see baptism as a way of bringing the child into the family of God, and then when they personally believe, they'll practice later what's called confirmation, where that child says, oh, I do now believe the things my parents initiated me into as an infant, and they'll practice confirmation. Biblically speaking, there is no legitimate biblical basis for or example of paedobaptism. We don't have any examples of infants being baptized. But as I said, we don't have examples of any children being baptized at all. So biblically, all we have to work with is adult baptism. Churches of Christ have always, as far as I know, practiced credo baptism, faith believers baptism, and that's the predominant view in the evangelical world and the Protestant world even today, with some notable exceptions. Our history comes from a group actually in Europe that were called the Anabaptists, Anna being the Greek term for again, and they were the people saying, you need to be baptized again. They were going around arguing with even the Reformers, the Swiss and the Calvinists and stuff, who had practiced infant baptism, saying, you need to be baptized again. They were persecuted all over Europe, and it's a fascinating story how they end up in America. But that's kind of our heritage, is with that particular point of view.
In Jewish culture, they become adults at 14?
See, this is you getting ahead of me, so I have a slide on that.
See?
Uh-huh. Yes. No, that's a good question. We want to know, what are Jewish practices and norms? That's a question we're going to have. So the question we have here is, infant, I can recognize an infant. I can recognize, I think, a believer. There's a lot of room in between those two where we have a lot of questions. Okay, when the Ethiopian eunuch says, here's water, baptize me, I'm like, okay, I know what he's doing. But in between here and there is a lot of room for discussion. So what we're going to do first for today is a little excursion that's not going to sound like it's about baptism. I'm going to talk about child development and the process of a child maturing into an adulthood and thinking about this in a big picture sense. So when we come back to baptism in a minute, or maybe next week, we'll have some sense of what we're talking about. Right up front, I'm going to tell you again that I'm biased. I have a point of view shaped by a few very clear facts to me that biased me. Number one, I've been a minister and a camp director for 15 years, which means I've not only been dealing with kids and baptism, I've been doing it in a couple of different environments. So I do have some experience to offer you. That doesn't mean I'm right, but I do. There are reasons you should at least listen to me. I've baptized a lot of kids. Not always felt good about it. In some cases I thought, There was one girl, anytime I talk about this, there's one girl that comes to mind. Parents were, grandparents, emphatic that she needed to be baptized. She barely had her head above the water of the baptistry. Once we were in the baptistry, she's like this tall, and I'm thinking, I've got to hold you up so you don't drown, and I do not feel good about this. And people in the crowd can't see her over the lip of the baptistry because she's that short. Now, she was a short girl. Doesn't mean she was not ready to be baptized, but in that moment, I'm like, I'm holding a very young child, and I don't feel good about this. And so I've had that experience quite a lot of times, and that bugs me as the guy who's in the water doing baptism, that I have to kind of live with that. I've baptized a lot of adults who regretted being baptized so young. You don't know about most of them because they're embarrassed. they come to me in the middle of the day and say, can you baptize me? I was baptized when I was 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever, and I don't have any confidence that I had any idea what I was doing. Could you baptize me as an adult? And I do it. We don't put it in the bulletin because they don't want to make a big deal about it. They don't want their parents to think they failed them or something by baptizing them at a young age. But baptism, instead of being a source of confidence later in life, I'm a baptized believer, became an obstacle to them, where it became a source of doubt. And I interact with that, and I admit you guys don't have to interact with that unless you yourself are going through it. It's something that, it's the side of that story that only I see, and that biases me in this discussion. I was rebaptized as an adult. I had this exact experience. It may not surprise you, I was a really smart kid, which means at a very young age, I could say whatever needed to be said to convince my Christian parents that I needed to be baptized. I could recite it and give lessons on it if you wanted. Okay, I started preaching at 15. What age do you think I was baptized? Okay, that was me. However, maturity-wise, I was still a dumb little kid. And later in life, for better or worse, right, I'm not even arguing that I made a good decision. I'm saying later in life, it began to bother me to the point where I was just consumed with doubt. I'm a camp director and a minister, not sure about my own baptism. So late one night in a horse trough at Frog Road Christian Camp, with no one there but the cook, a full moon, and a counselor, and my wife, I'm baptized. And again, don't tell anybody, because the last thing I want are kids going home saying, yeah, our director was baptized this week. So, wait. So again, it was a moment for me that was difficult that I experienced. I baptized another adult that night, who I won't tell you his name, because to this day he doesn't want anybody to know that he had that doubt, that it's an embarrassment to him that he struggled with that, and he doesn't want his parents to think that it's a rebuke of them that they failed him some way as a kid. It's an awkward thing, okay? So that said, I've not yet baptized my own son or even had this conversation. So I'm just telling you up front, on the table, those are Ben's biases that you don't share. It's good for you to hear that point of view I'm going to give you. That doesn't make that definitive, right? That doesn't mean that you're going to have to decide the way I've decided, or if I'll decide the way I've decided. Does that make sense? It's just that's the stuff that goes through my mind when you ask me this question, and that's what I'm going to try to share with you today. Child development, how does it work? Examples of baptism in the book of Acts are adults in the missionary era. Okay, the gospel is going to places it has never gone, because it's never gone anywhere, and they're hearing the gospel, something they don't know, they've never heard before, and saying, yeah, I believe that. Here's water, let's do it. Okay? That is not an obvious parallel to our situation, where we have established churches and children growing up in that environment, hearing it all their life. It's hard to parallel the Ethiopian eunuch who hears a sermon and says, hey, that's it, let's do it, to a kid who's growing up and has his name on the star wall and he's learning all the stuff. It's hard to figure out the parallel. Didache is a document we have from the early church at the end of the first century. It's not part of the New Testament, and it's not supposed to be. It is the first church manual that we have in existence. And it was written by Christians who were just trying to answer the question, we're now established churches, we're not in a mission field anymore. We're second and third generation Christians in these churches, what do we do? And it has just straightforward, here's how you serve communion, here's how you do this. And it has a section on baptism. And I'll admit, it's a weird section. Like, it talks about the temperature of the water, right? I mean, it's really a manual of here's how to do baptism. Use running water if you can. Use cold water if you can. And if you can't, and then what if there's a section on what if there's no water, right? And that seems to be where sprinkling comes from. That if you were in a situation where there's absolutely no water, it says, well, then put some on their head as an exception to the rule, but not as a practice. No one was saying you should be sprinkling people. It was like, yeah, okay, fine. If you find yourself in the desert and someone wants to be baptized, then pour it on their head or something. Do the best you can. And that you can see where that went from there. Anyway, so this is an uninspired text. But what's interesting in it is when it discusses baptism, it shows you how it had shifted from the urgency of Acts, where you're in the mission context, to slow down and think about it in the established context. So Didache says, but before the baptism, let the baptizer, that's me, fast, and the baptized, also fast, and whatever others can, that you shall order the baptized to fast 1 or 2 days before. That you weren't saying, okay, I made our decision, let's do it now, you could die on the way there, you could fall out of your chariot and die, right? Now, there's no discussion like that. It was, slow down and think about it. You should fast and pray about it. anybody that's around you should fast and pray about it. The person doing the baptism should fast and pray about it. And there was, it was a more methodical approach. We're going to slow down and talk about this. So, as churches settled into normalcy, baptism was approached more deliberately and slowly. So in our context, we have a little bit of both. So have you guys met Dan yet? The guy we got to baptize a week or two back? Older guy, I'm guessing he's mid-80s, okay? Jerry Morgan calls me up in the middle of the day, so I'm studying with Dan. He wants to be baptized. We're on our way right now. Okay, we baptize 80-year-old man on a Tuesday in the middle of the day. Okay, it was great. That's more like a mission situation. You have a full-grown man at the end of his life saying, why am I waiting for? Let's go do it. And yeah, you bet we baptized him. With younger kids, it's a little different. Okay, and for me, the advice of Didache makes a little more sense. Let's not get in too big a hurry. Let's talk about it. These kids are still minors, right? Not an 80-year-old man. God knows they're minors. And so there's a slower, more methodical approach in that situation. How do we talk about adolescence? In virtually every culture, past and present and presumably future, adulthood is reached in stages. Okay? You don't suddenly go from an infant to an adult overnight. It happens incrementally, with rites of passage or recognition delineating those stages. There are moments where you say, ooh, they grew up a bit. For parents, that's even harder because we see them day by day and they just look the same to us, and then one day you turn around and they're outgrown all their clothes, right? But it's the people they don't see. They haven't seen them in a year and they say, oh, you've grown up, you know, and they kind of see the incremental stage-based growth of a child. The thresholds are often arbitrary and may not recognize an individual child's intellectual, spiritual, social, moral development. So even if there was a magic age, and I could say, at the age of 11 and a half, you have become an adult. Does anybody think that would be the same for every person? No. Okay. Even in adulthood, a person will continue to develop throughout life. So it's not like you get to adulthood and now I'm done growing. It doesn't work that way. So I'm 36 now, and I look back at 8 years ago, the minister the Glenpool Church of Christ hired was 28 years old. And I think, wow, that kid was an idiot. Why did they hire him? Right? And that's just, you know, in the last 8 years. And I think about that. I mean, that you continue developing. So it's not like you hit a plateau. And that's part of the struggle. A lot of people, I mentioned people that come to me and say, I want to be baptized again. A lot of them say, well, I'm so much more mature now than I was then. And I want to say, well, I hope so. you're supposed to be going that way, not backwards, right? So baptism is a marker of some sort of development, right? It's supposed to hit one of those stages in theory. Problem is, we don't know which one it is. It's hard to identify. Which threshold are they crossing over in baptism? What are we looking for? What are Jewish cultural norms, to Jared's point? That's actually a hard question to answer. At 12, a young girl becomes a daughter of the covenant. She has a bat mitzvah, which is a ceremony, a celebration that represents her being now old enough to be part of the covenant community. At 13, boys have their bar mitzvah, son of the commandment. Mitzvah is commandment. Okay, you're a son of the commandments now. And you're expected to start acting like a Jewish young man. Are you a Jewish young man or young woman? No, they're not going to treat you like an adult now. But you are now expected to start participating in Jewish life in that way. At 16 and 18 years old, some Reformed Jewish communities will have a confirmation where they say, now let's see if you actually listened back when you were 13 or 12. And they'll kind of go back over what it means to be Jewish. In the Bible, no one is counted as an adult in the Hebrew Scriptures until they're 20. When they do a census, they don't count you as a man of war until you're 20 years old. So do you see that, again, it's incremental. There's a whole range there. There's not like a moment where you say, yep, that's it. Even boys and girls differ in that cultural setup. And that's a little tricky. There's a fun text, fun for nerds, probably not for you. Parkei Avot is a rabbinic document that talks in one section about what it means to grow up. I'm going to read you the section, then I'm going to tell you what it means. So just hang on with me. But it gives like all the stages of life development in 5 and 10 year increments. He says 5 years of age are for scripture, 10 for Mishnah, 13 for observing the commandments, 15 for Talmud, 18 for the wedding canopy, 20 for pursuits, 30 for strength, 40 for understanding, 50 for giving counsel, 60 for mature age, 70 for a hoary head, 80 for super added strength, 90 is the age for bending stature, 100 is as if you dead, passed away, and ceased from the world. Rabbis are brutal. That's the way it is. You get to 100, we're done with you. Right? Why are you still here? It's a little harsh, okay? Devin, you're kind of... No.
Halfway.
Yeah. Okay. So what's interesting is they recognize various stages of development, even in interacting with children. At 5 years old, they expect you to start learning something about Torah. It's time. You're old enough. You can put sentences together. We can teach you something. What do we do in our STARS program? Okay, 3, 4, and 5 years old, we're going to expect you to start figuring out who Adam and Eve are. Now, we're going to give you some basic ground, and we even start in the Torah. We start with Genesis and say, all right, let's give you some stuff to learn. We don't expect you to make moral decisions, but we expect you to now start thinking about the Bible a little bit. At 10, it says it's time for the Mishnah, which is the interpretive tools of the Bible and Judaism. And so it's a way of saying it's time for curiosity about Scripture. At 8, 9, 10 is when your kids are asking you tough questions. Hey, I was wondering. Oh, great. Right? And it's always like when you got your mouth full. Okay. This is a curiosity time. At 15, they expect you to start doing something about it. It's old enough now at 15, we can start treating you like you're under the covenant. We can say, hey, you're a Jewish young man. You should be doing this. But no one actually thinks you're a man. We should just start treating you that way at 15. Interesting, at 18, you could get married. You didn't move out to 20. I mean, nobody thought you were grown up enough to actually go run a household. So, yeah, if you want to get married, sure, you can live in that bedroom right there. And that, you know, the typical Jewish community would operate that way, which is strange to us. But you weren't even then considered a competent adult until you were 30, even after you moved out and had your own family. What age does Jesus start his teaching ministry? Because nobody wanted to listen to a 29-year-old. You guys hired me at 28. I don't know what you're thinking. Yeah, so you're not a competent adult until 30 is why. So you see, it's an incremental process. In the life of Jesus himself, you get a hint at some of those developments in the book of Luke. In Luke 2, Jesus the infant visits the temple. Okay, rite of initiation. Okay, and then in Luke 2:40 it says, and he grew, and that's all you get. You don't see him again until he's 12 years old, and he visits the temple. What did we see in that last little passage? It's 12 is the age of curiosity and questions, right? What does he do at the temple?
Teaches.
Yeah, he's arguing with the leaders and the teachers about the law and asking them questions, and they're not giving good answers, so he's telling them what it is, yeah? And so you get that moment, yep, he hit that mark, check. And then it says in Luke 2:52, and he grew in wisdom and stature in favor of God and man, and we don't see him again until he's 30. Okay. So, again, that would be the way a Jewish culture would think about it. Does that mean that's the way we have to think about it? No. It's just, when you're thinking about it, this is a good set of kind of benchmarks to look back at and say, what might the early church have thought about child development? It might have looked something like this. What about in our culture? When do you become a man in American culture? Well, yeah, it's hard to say, right? We actually have a mixed bag of answers to that, Gundy notwithstanding. What if you're growing up in an American family, what are the ages that you look forward to that matter?
16.
16 why?
You can drive.
You can drive, okay. Who picked 16? I don't know. Yeah. What other age?
18.
Why? Are you?
An adult.
Okay, so legally, we can start thinking of you as an adult. Before that, if you want to be treated as an adult, you kind of have to divorce your parents. But there are emancipation protocols even for that. There are situations where people younger than that are tried as adults in courts. It happens. But ground rule, 18, what can you do at 18?
Vote.
After an amendment, right? Originally, it wasn't 18, but now it is. What else can you do?
Military.
You're old enough, we can draft you. And... you can buy cigarettes. I mean, come on. This is a big deal, folks. This is important. Yeah. I mention that because what's the next age? Yeah. So it's interesting in our culture that we have kind of these arbitrary benchmarks. What happens at 21? We'll give you a tank at 18. You can enlist.
Yeah.
But alcohol at 21. So we kind of have these arbitrary benchmarks that are not necessarily consistent with each other. But we have some. And that's part of the struggle. You as a parent are trying to decide, okay, now baptism. Where does that go? Our culture is helping you, but not a lot, in terms of child development. And there are other factors involved. This is going to get to my biology kick, but some of the foods we eat in modern American culture affect the physiology of child development when they hit puberty and things like that. And so there's some evidence that that age is actually moving based on diet. Culture, if you grow up in a stable home, your responsibilities of adulthood happen later. If you grow up where you're basically a parent, if you grow up where you're basically a parent at 12 raising kids, my dad's mother died when he was 8. He had to grow up a lot faster than a lot of other adults. So again, there's a lot of things that are involved in that that we kind of get confused about. So let's talk about a few just to kind of get some guidelines again, what things are out there. Talking to girls different than talking to boys. Our culture talks to three pretty discrete acts or events in a girl's life when we talk about her as hitting a threshold. Never forget, first time a mother comes to me and said, "My little girl became a woman at camp this week." I said, "She did what?" We don't allow that here. Okay. So, there are different acts. Her first period, marriage, or her first sexual experience, which may not be in that order, right? Our culture would say those are thresholds of initiation, of maturation, that the child is growing up. None of these are necessarily helpful. Again, does that tell you when a child needs to be baptized? Any one of those? Not really. But that's the kind of stuff we have to work with, that you throw into the hopper and say, okay, here's the information I've got. Let's spin it around and see what I can do. With boys, it's even less helpful because there aren't even those first set of discrete moments for boys. A boy's voice is going to change over the course of quite a period of time. It's hard to tell as puberty develops in boys, so it's not clear at all. Kevin East, who I don't often like on this particular topic, but this one point he has that's pretty good, he commented that a boy becomes a man in our culture when an older man tells him he is. That for most young men, there's a moment in his life when somebody said, "You're a man now." Mm-hmm. And that's what we got. Right? There's no clear initiation ritual. And I put this picture up here. Anybody remember the movie Master and Commander? Russell Crowe? And it's this picture of British Navy, and you got this 12-year-old kid who's an officer on the ship because he's a noble son, right? And it's assumed if you're noble, you clearly outrank a 38-year-old sailor. So we'll have a 12-year-old. So again, different cultures have seen that operate in very different ways. And our current culture, I think most of us would say, maybe not so much 12-year-olds captaining a ship, but
he lost his arm and kept fighting.
He did okay, right? The British would say he did fine. He is an Englishman, right? So yeah, these are our struggles. So what, I've only got 5 minutes left to kind of finish up the child development section of this before next week we get back to how do we apply that. What guidelines do I find helpful? Last week we talked about how you talk about the cross to children. Okay, we said you wouldn't show just any child the Passion of the Christ, a rated R movie. Okay, I wouldn't show Lucas the Passion of the Christ. He would be in a tear-filled puddle in my living room floor, right? I know my kid, that's where he would be at 9 years old, where he is emotionally. On the other hand, we said, you know, maybe you could start with the Narnia scene where we're killing a lion, and you get kind of a metaphor that's a little less robust and not as quite as aggressive. Even that, Lucas is going to cry through that, right? Because he's tenderhearted and you can't kill lions. I mean, come on. I mean, it's a really disturbing set of images. And then before that, we said, you know, it may be that when they're little, you just can't talk to them about the cross in a useful way, because you're talking about concepts that they're not going to get very well. They don't understand death very well at very young ages and so forth. I would say whatever you came up with when you were thinking about that answer is very close to what you should think about for baptism. Okay? When a person is able to seriously encounter the story of the cross, Passion of the Christ level engagement, that person is ready to seriously think about baptism. That's a good indicator. when a child, you think a child is only at a point where we have to touch on the cross at kind of a distance. We can talk about it, but only in kind of shapes and shadows and lines. Then that's probably the way you should talk about baptism. Does it mean you can't talk about it? No, you can talk about it. But just, you're not leaning into it like you would a more mature person. If you can't talk to your child about the cross at all because of a maturity issue, then I'm going to say to you as your minister, I don't think you should be talking to them about baptism, because the two are intrinsically connected. There is no doctrine of baptism without the cross, and there is a need to be able to talk about both. And so if you're telling me, well, I haven't talked to them, I haven't really told them the story of the cross in a meaningful way yet, but I'd like them to be baptized and have that be meaningful, I'm going to say, well, there's a disconnect there. I'm not going to fight you on it, because as I said, these are Ben's think-sos. I'm just giving you some guidelines to help. That Ben's two cents would be that I assess their interaction with the cross as running parallel to their interaction with baptism and that initiation. Okay? Is that definitive, set in stone? Again, no. But just has some helpful guidelines. It helps me measure when I'm myself thinking I have a 9-year-old son, what does he know about the cross? What is he able to understand about the cross? That's the level of understanding I expect him to be able to have about baptism. And that's where I'm going to leave it for today. So what I want you to do, go home and think about that this week. Next week, we're going to pick up here and then start applying that. And that's where we'll start building your questions. Hey, Ben, I thought about that, and that was garbage. Okay, that's where we'll get all that next week. Those are just some helpful guidelines. Thanks for your attention, guys.